Support for Utah Public Radio is provided by Utah Festival Opera and Musical Theater, July 11th through August 11th in Logan, presenting Passion, Power, and Politics in Puccini's Gothic thriller, Tosca. Information is at utahfestival.org.
Welcome to Access Utah. This is Sherry Quinn. It is common to hear about a world going greener, but the afterworld? Joining us is Jerry Grace Lyons, an advocate for what are known as green burials, natural burials, or eco burials. And Lyons is also a death midwife, pioneering an old profession, helping people to move more peacefully to their death. She is the founder and executive director of Final Passages, a company dedicated to alternative funeral practices. Producer Susie Montgomery talked to Lyons at her home in Northern California.
A green burial ensures the burial site remains as natural as possible. Interment of bodies is done in a biodegradable casket, shroud, or blanket. No embalming fluid, no concrete vaults. It is not something most of us think about every day, but the environmental impact of death is huge. American funerals are responsible each year for the felling of 30 million board feet of casket wood, including some tropical hardwoods, 90,000 tons of steel. That's like burying a San Francisco Golden Gate Bridge every year. 800,000 gallons of embalming fluid, not to mention the concrete needed for burial vaults. Brandon Burningham is the manager of Memorial Mortuaries and Cemeteries.
This is a statistic that says that each year we're burying about 1.6 million tons of concrete into our earth.
There's an increasing demand for natural burial practices, which has spawned changes, and dozens of funeral homes and cemeteries across the country have started to adopt greener ways that do not require 6 feet deep. Lyons asked a funeral and cemetery owner in Sebastopol, California, to hop on this new trend.
Just this year, I had a family who wanted to have a burial of their daughter in just a shroud that's a cloth wrapped around her body, beautiful cloth. And I had actually spoken to Steve previously about it, and he was concerned about how we would get a person into the ground, how we would lower them in a ground safely. And I told him that I knew about a woman who was creating shrouds. She lives in San Francisco, and she had created a shroud that was used on the TV show 6 Feet Under. And I said, look, if they've put this person in the ground safely on the television show, I know that we can do it. And I said, this family really wants to do this. And he said, okay, let's try it. And later, when I went with the family to talk to him about the arrangement, I said, Steve, you know, actually, a true green grave is a shallow grave, like 3 to 4 feet deep, not 6 feet deep, because there's no living organisms down that deep. And there's no casket, so there's no reason to put someone in that deep. And he said, okay, if you'd like it shallow, I'll dig it about, you know, 3.5 or 4 feet deep. So the family went and bought a shroud from this woman, Esmeralda, and she has a business called Kinkaraco. They chose a white linen one. She has different kinds. And we had a whole ceremony with wrapping her in the shroud. And the bottom, they purchased the model with a bottom layer that had herbs like rosemary and sage or lavender. And she made little pockets that were filled with these herbs. And it was attached to the bottom. So it smelled very fragrantly beautiful. And like I said, the straps were already sewn on very securely. So then this family, they were kind of missing the ritual that that we, our organization, pretty much created, which was to decorate a casket, the family painting or putting pictures on, decoupaging, collaging, doing hand fingerprints, all of those things on a casket. And I said to the mother of the person who died, how about if we get a cardboard cremation casket and all of you decorate it? And then after we place your daughter in the shroud, we'll put her in the box for transporting her to the cemetery. And she loved that idea. So the woman who died, she had an 11-year-old son, and he and all his friends painted the casket. And then we did this ritual of placing her in the shroud, and then we placed her shroud in the painted casket when it was completed. And that's what we used to bring her up to the cemetery. And we laid the box beside the grave. And after they did their service and prayers and singing, whatever they were going to do, they lifted the top of the cardboard casket and took her out in the shroud and walked the shroud over the grave and gently lowered her in. And it was real easy. There was no strain or stress, and it all went very smooth. And then they threw a lot of flowers in with her, and it was really beautiful. And then her son, her 11-year-old son, and all of his friends grabbed shovels and started shoveling the dirt in, and they filled in the grave a lot of the way.
Wow. So you were saying this is the only green burial site
that I'm aware of in California besides Fernwood. There may be some others. I don't know of them. I know that when I first started doing this work about 15 years ago, I helped a family up in Healdsburg, which is just north of here. It's still in our county. And there's a cemetery up there called Oak Mound. And at the time, they still had burial sites on a hillside. And I remember that one did not have a cement liner. And that struck me then, you know, wow, there's no cement in the ground. This is beautiful. It's just the pine box going down into the actual earth. How wonderful, you know, that it can break down and we can return to the earth really easily and quickly the way I believe we were meant to do. And that was the first time. And then I also took part in a green burial on some people's land. They had gotten permission. They're up north a ways in another county. They had gotten permission from their county planning or zoning to bury people on their land because they had found, it was a large piece of land, and they had found some grave sites. And the planning commission or whoever they were speaking to said, well, if you can prove that there's at least four people buried there, we'll let you keep burying your family members there. There was about 16 families that went in together to buy this huge piece of land. And they found an Indian chief who swore in an affidavit that there had been other people, other Native Americans buried there. And so they gave him a permit to go ahead and keep burying people there. Well, somebody died, and they contacted me, and I had the wonderful opportunity and privilege of helping them. It was actually the husband of one of my students who had taken my courses. And so I helped her with her husband, and they dug the grave themselves out there on the land and in this area where there were some other headstones. And it was the first time I'd ever just done land, somebody's private land burial.
Green burial is an environmental movement, but it goes beyond that. I can think of the environmental aspect, the personal touch aspect, and then just
closure.
The spiritual idea of a body returning to the earth. So those are the three things I can think of. What does it mean to you?
Well, it helping families with home funerals and green burial overall is very rewarding for me because I see people move through fear. By watching them, I experience it. It's almost a visceral experience. I see them go through a lot of their anxieties and fears and move to a place of love, of feeling good inside, that they've been a part of something much bigger than themselves, whether it's a spiritual aspect. I would call it spiritual. They experience love in the room where the person's lying in honor. They experience that all the way through the whole home funeral process, which often is 3 days and even longer. And in that time, they have time to say their goodbyes. So there's a lot of closure that happens. They're feeling like they've said things to the person. They've gotten to sit with them and hold their hand. There's touching them. And in that touch, their body is recognizing death, that death has occurred. They're able to integrate it slowly. And it is not something that they're feeling the body's been ripped away from them. So the other thing is they're visually seeing, but also feeling in their whole body and through other senses, the change that's coming over the person who died. So there's a certain, almost a glow around a person who has died initially, be it an energetic glow or just the love that's surrounding them. They still seem very much alive in many ways. And slowly over the next couple of days, that wanes, and the features of the person begin to change. The features, like the eyes sink a little bit and the skin sags a little bit. Those body changes help them to see that the body is now looking more like a shell and not like the loved one that they remember and communicated with. And as that happens, they begin to accept that it's time to let go. So it's not somebody else deciding for them. They're feeling it inside of them, and they are the ones that say, it's time to let them go. It's time to take them to the crematorium or the cemetery. And that is a world of difference. So be it spiritual, be it ecological, be it that we're feeding the earth, which is a wonderful thing because the earth has fed us all through our life. It's nurtured us. Now we're nurturing the earth back, giving back to it, saying thanks. Also, a lot of people are turning to this way of burial and or the home funeral approach for economic reasons. We are faced today with huge economic challenges, and families creating their own home funerals and participating from beginning to end saves them a lot of money and just turning it over to a mortuary. Mm-hmm. So that's why a friend and I wrote a guidebook on how to create your own home funeral. People can follow that. And in most states, it's completely legal to do all parts of the arrangements, including filling out and filing your paperwork with your state, and transporting the body to the crematorium or cemetery in any kind of vehicle that will hold the casket. So most people have the legal rights, and I founded Final Passages to be able to inform people about these rights, because there are very few people know that they have them. And where are they going to find this out? There's certainly not funeral directors are not going to tell them that, oh, by the way, you don't really have to use our service. You can go out and do this yourself if you want. Mm-hmm. So it's a big job to educate people and also to change from the way we've been doing things for a number of years now.
So if somebody dies, I'm really ignorant about this, actually. Someone dies, like say just someone I knew died in my house. I wouldn't even know who to call. Like, that's where I think none of us really deal with death or prepare or have a game plan for death, mm-hmm. even though it's very much a part of life. So you're saying that if someone dies, you have many options. What is one of the options, rather than calling a funeral home, which is probably what I would do, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe not anymore. But
Good point.
But it true. Is about educating people, because you kind of panic, or you're grieving, or whatever, all of those emotions. So what would just a synopsis of your of what you try to educate?
Well, I think we have to begin with talking about what kind of death. Is it a death that's expected, where somebody has been diagnosed with a terminal illness, or if it's something sudden and the person had a heart attack or an aneurysm or something and they suddenly dropped on the floor, or you walked in the house and found your mom and she had died and you had no idea why. Those are two really separate types of deaths. The one where somebody knows that they're dying and the family is aware of it, the doctor is aware, those are the easier ones to have a home funeral. For instance, in our county, you can just keep somebody at home after they die. Often they'll call hospice if the person has been on hospice care, or they might have caregivers in the house. And then they can just keep the person at home, prepare their body, wash their body, buy some dry ice or some form of ice, and use the ice to preserve their body during the time they're lying in honor. That's what we term it, lying in honor, or lying in grace. And if you use dry ice, it preserves the body very well, and not much changes in those next few days. Actually, I've helped a number of families keep somebody at home 5 and 6 days without any problem at all. Also, we use essential oils when we bathe the person, so that also helps keep any bacteria growth down. Those are some of the things I teach my midwives, how to use oils and all those beautiful things, rituals. Then when they're ready, and again, they can purchase a cardboard casket from us and decorate it while the person's lying on the bed, and then they can place the person in the box. They can also be getting paperwork done, or if they have one of us midwives assisting them, then we can help them with all those details.
I really love that you call yourself a midwife, a death midwife, right?
Yeah.
And I'm really, really wanting to delve into that a little bit more. So, as you said, you and your midwives, and you train women and men, or just women?
Men too, but men show up a lot less than women at our workshops, at our courses. I think traditionally it's been women that have brought babies into the world, and many of those same women used to help people out of this world, and they were often called shrouding women, I think because they often bathed the person and wrapped them in cloth, and then maybe they were put in a home-built casket and buried on the land. I think midwives can be anything. Death midwives can be help the person who's dying. They can help them spiritually get past fears of what's next. They can talk that through with them, bring comfort to them, help them deal with whatever concerns they have. Maybe they haven't made an arrangement for their animal. Where's their pet going to go? Where's their children going to go if they have any things that are important to them? They can, you know, because we don't always know what's bothering people who are dying that are looking fearful or agitated. So a spiritual midwife can be somebody who helps sit with a person and move through fears.
Can you speak from experience there? Is there one particular instance where you felt that this profession truly came to fruition for you, where you really understood what your role was?
I had been going to Carolyn's Reiki group for about a year, and as soon as I met her, we felt like we were old friends. And we just had this great relationship. So she was just became a dear friend of mine. And I felt like she was family. And so there we were in shock. And it was an unbelievable fact, but not something we could take in immediately. And fortunately, Carolyn had made these instructions. And that night we all met, and her very close friend of over 20 years, Norma, explained to us that she had talked to the hospital about bringing Carolyn's body home. But they wanted to see paperwork done, and they didn't know who Norma was, and they just said, please, you know, we have to have some paperwork completed. And so Norma hired a funeral home to get the paperwork done because she didn't know how to do it, and she wanted to do it quickly. So by the next day, we were able to go back to the hospital and bring her body home. And that part, I was involved in the care of her body, in the washing, in the dressing of her body. We put makeup on her. We surrounded her with flowers. We had her laid out in our healing room where we did Reiki. And people started coming by. We had formed a phone tree and let everybody in the community know. And so people started coming by and sitting with her. And then in the evening, we brought her out in the living room, laying on a futon on the floor, and we all surrounded her, and we told stories about her and how we knew her and met all of her friends that we didn't know. And it was such a profound experience, like touching her body and washing her and everything felt so natural and something very ancient. And I think it brought up memories of me doing this in a past life or something like that. I felt certain that it was something that felt ordinary and extraordinary at the same time. And so I was so moved in those few days. And then we didn't know we could decorate the box, or we would have, but we put her on the futon and took her back, took her over to the crematorium, and then placed her in the box they had prepared. And then they cremated her. And we brought the ashes back home, passed those around to the people in the circle, and said, because Carolyn had written in her instructions that she wanted her ashes scattered in sacred, beautiful places around the world. So all of us who wanted to take some, put some in little bags, and we had a part of her with us. And so I have done that, scattered them in beautiful places, and had amazing experiences with that too. The first one was when I was on a 3-day whitewater rafting trip, and on that last day, I remembered that I was going to do that, so I got them, and I was on the raft with a group of people, and I said some blessings and prayers and scattered them over the edge. And then I was looking in the little bag to make sure, you know, I had it up by my eyes really close, and I was looking to see that all the ashes were out of the little bag, and a huge dragonfly landed right in front of my eyes. Huge! And it was just sitting there looking at me, and I was like, oh, wow, where did you come from? We were out in the middle of the river. And I'm like, wow! And everybody else was watching this, and they were all just, oh, that's amazing. Well, Carolyn's here, or at least her spirit is here. And so the dragonfly became my logo of my business. And so if you look around in my room, you'll see dragonflies everywhere in my surrounding. They're scattered around. But there's some on my altar and behind you, and yeah, just everywhere. So I knew that she was there.
That experience marked the beginning of Jerry Lyon's career as a death midwife and her commitment to the eco-burial movement that is growing across the nation. And some Utah graves are going green. Brandon Burningham is manager of Memorial Mortuaries and Cemeteries in Utah. One of his cemeteries in Bountiful has a designated green burial section, which includes a biodegradable casket, either the traditional plain pine box, poplar, willow, or woven seagrass. And they use refrigeration instead of embalming fluid. They also offer an eco-friendly funeral and interment in a natural setting in the foothills above Bountiful.
A few that have been buried there, and the families have not actually placed a marker yet. But when they do, we are using just a rock or a boulder, something that's more natural for the setting than, you know, bronze, okay, or even, you know, granite. If you see a headstone in the cemetery, I mean, still that doesn't. But if you have a boulder there or a rock, that it may be engraved with the person's name, date of death. Those are kind of what we have envisioned for that area. So as you walk around, it's very peaceful. And again, this is just one area that we've set aside, and we fully expect that as we go from infancy to, you know, full-blown adulthood here and on this movement, that we're going to need to dedicate more acreage for this type of service.
At the time of this interview, there was only one eco-burial in the works, and a handful of Utahns are attending Jerry Grace Lyon's Death Midwifery workshops. For more information on the trends, legalities, and how to get involved, visit her website at finalpassages.org. For Access Utah, I'm Susie Montgomery.
Stay tuned for Science Questions up next.
Support for Science Questions comes from the College of Science at Utah State University, where students step beyond the classroom, participating in advanced research in the lab, field, and outer space. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information at usu.edu/science.
Welcome to the Beehive Archive, a two-minute look at some of the most pivotal and peculiar events in Utah's history. I'm Megan Van Frank. This week, learn about historic Copperton, the tiny mining town that defied the odds. First this.
The Beehive Archive is brought to you on Utah Public Radio by the Utah Humanities Council, with support from a We the People grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Lawrence T. and Janet T. D. Foundation.
The commercial mining industry has driven Utah's economic, political, and social development. Most towns associated with the mining industry went through typical boom and bust cycles, and many are now nothing more than ghost towns. But one mining town in Utah defied those odds. 6 miles east of Kennecott's famous copper pit in the Ochre Mountains lies the small community of Copperton. Its development is unique for a Utah mining town, as is evident by its quaint homes, Art Deco church, and community park. Copperton is an authentic 1930s suburbia. Kennecott was formerly known as the Utah Copper Company, or UCC, and in 1926, its executives decided to construct a new housing area for UCC workers. Unlike typical Utah mining towns, with crowded streets and densely packed boarding houses, Copperton was going to be different. This became evident as soon as construction began. Model brick and stucco homes were planned on plotted out streets around the already existing UCC baseball diamond. A community park was laid out, and a high school and religious buildings were constructed. Electricity was installed, and the paved streets had sidewalks and gutters. UCC employees and their families could rent a 5-room Copperton home for $27.50 per month, with UCC in charge of the upkeep. Homes were built between 1926 and 1930. The town of Copperton has endured the years of economic ups and downs associated with the mining industry. As a result of expanded mining operations in nearby Bingham Canyon, all company towns in the area, except for Copperton, were demolished in the late 20th century. Copperton eventually transitioned from a company town to private ownership, and while some non-residential structures were torn down, all of the homes are still standing and beautifully kept and occupied by current residents. As the only UCC mining town to remain intact, Copperton was added to the National Register of Historic Places in 1986. Research and writing for this episode of the Beehive Archive were provided by Heidi Orchard. Sources and past episodes may be found at utahhumanities.org. For the Beehive Archive, a production of the Utah Humanities Council, I'm Megan Van Frank.
Support for Science Questions is also brought to you by Apogee Instruments of Cache Valley, creating innovative sensors for measuring climate change, sustainable food production, and renewable energy. More information is at apogeeinstruments.com.
Thank you.
to Science Questions. I'm Sherry Quinn. Canadian John Valiant is the author of The Tiger, a true story of vengeance and survival. It is the stuff of adventure movies, but it goes much deeper. Valiant explains the true story behind the book.
In 1997, the Russian economy had collapsed during the 1990s. You know, communism went away, and you know, we all thought that was wonderful, but it was very destructive to Russians because nothing filled the gap. So in the Russian Far East, in Primorsky Krai, where this story takes place, mostly loggers and miners and people like that, it's all, you know, resource extraction. Those industries collapsed, and these people were simply abandoned in the forest, literally abandoned. So they had to go hunting. There was no, they had families. And this one fellow, Vladimir Markov, was a heavy equipment operator for a logging company. No more work, no more opportunity, and so he went hunting. And that was illegal too. But he had to do it to feed his family. And the tragedy was that there were tigers living in his area. The Chinese border was 50 miles away. The money that represented by a dead tiger in terms of its value on the Chinese market was irresistible to him. And he shot this tiger and wounded it. And the tiger identified him and hunted him, followed him back to his cabin, killed his dogs, started systematically destroying his belongings, and waited for him. And this man was a hunter. This was his cabin. This was his place. He left seeking the kind of the counsel and advice of some other hunters and trappers in the area. But eventually he had to come back, partly because his dogs, he knew that's where his dogs were going to go. And they were his hunting dogs. His livelihood depended on them. But also because that was his home. And, you know, he was a Russian. He wasn't an indigenous guy. He wasn't a native guy for whom the tigers are deities. He was a Russian guy. And a Russian guy isn't going to let a tiger run him off his property. So he went back. He was armed. He was ready. But the tiger was readier. The tiger was waiting by his front door and attacked him head on. Wasn't hiding. Was sitting in the open, essentially with its arms crossed, waiting for him to come back. It was like a hit. And he killed this man and ate him. And that set a whole nother series of events because the tiger then killed another hunter, another armed man who was a poacher, who knew there was a dangerous tiger out there, but killed him in the same way, confrontationally, coming at him from the open, not hiding. And despite the fact that both these men were armed, former soldiers, skilled hunters, they could not stop this animal.
Producer Constance Crompton interviewed Valiant in October when he was in Salt Lake City as a guest of the University of Utah Creative Writing Program.
The Amur tiger is a subspecies popularly called the Siberian tiger, and it lives, in fact, beyond Siberia, nearly 5,000 miles from Moscow, in the remote realm of far eastern Russia. It is named after the Amur River, the third longest river in Asia and the longest undammed river in the world, located in an ecological paradise unique on Earth. It hosts the greatest biodiversity of any place in Russia and is the home of rare butterflies and an unclassifiable species of raccoon dog. This is the kingdom in which the Amur tiger reigns.
The Amur tiger is an amazing animal. It's generally believed to be the largest cat living today. They can grow over 10 feet long. They can weigh over 600 pounds. But they can also jump across a residential street. They can jump over a basketball hoop. They have this amazing combination of mass, kind of horse-sized mass, with this incredible grace and agility. I wouldn't say they're great runners. They're ambush hunters like all cats. And so they're very good in the short run, and they're incredibly powerful. So they have an almost kind of bear-like upper body strength, if you will. Very powerful shoulders, very powerful forepaws. And what you'll also notice about them, and this is really what distinguishes them from all other subspecies, is their incredible, incredibly lustrous and dense coat. So it's almost like, to get a visual on an Amur tiger, it's almost better to imagine a lynx, you know, that incredible brushy, bushy fur. And then imagine a lynx that weighs 500 pounds, and you're getting close to the visual impact of the Amur tiger. And they can survive as no other tigers can in Arctic conditions. The temperature in the Russian Far East can drop to minus 40, minus 50 degrees below zero, and they don't hibernate. They're out in the elements all the time. They often, the males particularly, hunt alone, so it's not like they can curl up with another tiger when it's cold. Of course, the cubs will do that with their mother, but a lone female, a lone male are completely out there, and they have to be these kind of perfectly self-contained units surviving under really extraordinary circumstances.
There's a theme that runs through your work. You explore what happens when human ambition and power collide, and I like that word, collide, with the natural world.
The tiger is a story of collisions, really almost at every level, and that's really what drew me to it. The environment is a place of collision in terms of it's the only place on Earth where species of the boreal, like timber wolves and wolverines and reindeer, overlap with species of the subtropics, like leopards, tigers, exotic birds, and butterflies. At the cultural level, this unique zone, this unique ecosystem lies right on the Russian-Chinese border. The Russian-Chinese border has always been contentious. And now there's an enormous amount of anxiety, especially on the Russian side, as China is so much in the ascendant now. There are Russians who are genuinely afraid of being overrun. On the environmental level, what you see on the Russian side of the border is so starkly different from what now remains on the Chinese side. They're, of course, the same ecosystem, separated only by a border. But on the Chinese side, everything has been scraped away. There are virtually no trees left. There are virtually no animals left. It's all been converted into arable land, which is seriously compromised now by overuse. You cross over into onto the Russian side of the border, and all of a sudden, the land is much healthier. And that in itself is a contradiction. We think of Russia generally as a kind of environmental disaster zone. And in fact, the Russian Far East, this small region of it, Primorsky Krai, also known as Primorya, is this last redoubt for the Siberian tiger, which I also call the Amur tiger. For tiger species around the world, I would say the Amur tiger has one of the best chances of any of the surviving subspecies.
Now, the parallels between Homo sapiens and tigers. At one point, you say they evolved to coexist.
The species Homo sapiens, we, are roughly the same age as tigers. And we evolved in Asia side by side. So the tiger is believed to have evolved and in China and then disseminated itself across Asia. So for Asian Homo sapiens, there's really no corner of their consciousness, no corner of their history that doesn't have tigers in it somewhere. So tigers have been informing the Asian consciousness effectively forever. And it's one reason they are, you know, considered sacred animals there. It's one reason they are so iconic there. And it's also one reason they are still consumed by many Asians. The tigers are poached and broken down into their component parts because of the magical, powerful properties that tigers are still believed to possess. And people still want to be close to that energy. And think of all the sports teams that call themselves tigers. Think of the huge insurance companies or oil companies. And the power of that animal has really transcended its borders, has transcended, you know, race and class and language and ethnicity, and has been embraced worldwide in a way that really very few other animals have. And one thing that I was thinking about, what is a tiger? You know, what does it really represent? And the tiger simultaneously represents power, sex, and danger. And yet, what other such symbol would a parent allow their six-year-old daughter to have a picture of on their wall? The tiger also represents this very cuddly, beautiful, appealing kind of poster child for the conservation movement. I mean, the versatility of this animal and its universal appeal to humans is, I think it's unmatched by any other creature.
There's something that you pointed out. There's a certain little pill that is aptly named.
Oh, yeah.
It's an interesting fact.
Yeah. One of the reasons Asians kill and break tigers down into various parts is for the tiger's aphrodisiac properties. So the genitalia of tigers are believed to enhance your sexual prowess. And the makers of Viagra seem to be aware of that. And Viagra, it translated into Sanskrit, it's a Sanskrit word originally, and it means tiger. And so just take one of these blue tiger pills and you will be a tiger too. And it's the shame is that drug can't penetrate more deeply into Asian culture, because I think it would save a lot of tigers' lives.
Since 1993, it has been a violation of international law to sell tiger parts for any purpose. The Chinese government has taken steps to prevent tiger poaching, but there are a number of tiger farms, and it is estimated that there are at least 4,000 captive-bred tigers on these farms.
I mean, there are lots of Chinese who understand that tigers are endangered. In terms of traditional Chinese medicine, which historically has used tiger parts, respectable practitioners of traditional Chinese medicine no longer endorse the use of tiger parts. Still, there is this kind of underground, kind of folk market, and also the status symbol of the tiger skin, of the fangs, of the claws is still very attractive to some people. But there are commercial businessmen, private enterprises in China who have decided to breed tigers in the hopes that this law will be overturned, or that somehow fate will turn their way and allow them to sell bred tigers. So there are about a dozen of these farms, you know, to call them farms is even that is kind of a misnomer, a dozen of these breeding complexes in China, and I visited one of these. And, you know, they're called breeding and rehabilitation centers, which is really window dressing. There's no rehabilitation going on. They're living in these tiny little pens, and then they are set out, you know, in these larger enclosures, you know, dozens of tigers all kind of mingling with each other, which is completely unnatural. Who knows what they're fed, honestly? It's not really clear what they're fed. And there's no way these animals could be returned to the wild, because they have no competence for surviving in the wild for reasons I described earlier. And so it's a very cynical enterprise, and it's there, and basically no one's quite sure what they do with the bodies. Do they, when they die, do they freeze them, or do they secretly distribute them into the market? And that's not clear. But when I was there, I went to one, and you could buy tiger wine and this giant glass vat of wine or something like wine with a tiger carcass in it, entire skeleton with ligaments and flesh hanging off the bone. And you ladle this out, and it's about $100 a liter. And this, again, is, you know, the promise of drinking such a beverage is to give you an exciting time with your sweetheart. So, I mean, it's bizarre and crazy seeming and shocking. And at the same time, you have to, you know, realize that the tiger has been a power animal, for lack of a better word, for Asians for tens of thousands, if not millions of years. I mean, it's deeply embedded in the consciousness and the spirituality and at every level of their belief systems. And also there are Chinese who are working actively to protect tigers. So there's a real tension. There's a real tension. But there's no question that these tiger farms are, they really are crimes against nature.
Maybe you could discuss a bit that dilemma or the conflict with the poachers. Their economic plight and the ironies of that.
So in Russia, there wasn't a tradition, if you will, of man-eating the way there has been in India and parts of China historically. Because there were fewer people, and in some ways, and the tigers and prey were more dispersed because it's at a higher latitude, which generally is what happens, there were fewer conflicts. And the indigenous people who still live in Russia, in the Russian Far East, the Udigay, the Nanai, for them that the tiger was a god, you know, a land-based deity. And you don't kill your gods. You respect your gods. You stay out of their way. And even for the Russian Christian hunters who came to the Far East, they had this kind of live and let live attitude. And it was different for farmers, because farmers didn't like having their tigers killed, their livestock killed by tigers. But for many of the people in the Far East, the Russians are hunters and trappers. So they're hunting the same game that the tigers are. They're working the same forests, following the same rivers. And yet there was little conflict historically. And there was an attitude among the Russians whom I met, and they said, if I don't touch her, the tiger, she won't touch me. And that all changed when the Russian border with China opened, and when perestroika engineered the collapse of the communist social and economic structure. So throughout the 90s, you've had desperately poor Russians who are now able to trade freely with Chinese. And all of a sudden, the tiger, who was a kind of cohabitor of the forest, a fellow hunter, all of a sudden had this enormous price tag attached to it, because Chinese were willing to pay extraordinary sums, tens of thousands of dollars, for a dead tiger. And for Russians, who hadn't had a steady job in years at this point, by the mid-90s, who were feeding their families literally off the forest, the opportunity and the temptation that a tiger presented was enormous and irresistible. And that changed the whole dynamic. Basically, the opening of the border and the collapse of the Soviet Union and the economy that it, however clumsily, supported and maintained, completely destabilized decades of stability in the human-tiger relationship.
Why should the tiger be saved in its natural habitat?
The tiger is a canary in the coal mine. What the tiger is, you know, beyond this extraordinarily beautiful animal and keystone species and apex predator, what it also is, it's a symbol of health. It's a symbol of health for a much greater system. In other words, because it's an apex predator, everything needs to be intact underneath it for the tiger to be supported, because the tiger feeds on deer and boar. So for the deer and boar to survive in numbers to support tigers, there has to be enough nuts and grass and leaves for them to eat. There needs to be enough intact forest for them to hide and raise their young safely. So all these other systems need to be in place. The water, of course, needs to be clean and healthy. There needs to be control of hunting pressure by humans, just so there's enough game for the tigers to eat. So if all that's in place, what you have then is an intact and healthy ecosystem. And, you know, we have some, you know, examples of that all over the American West, up in Canada. You have places that support, you know, in some ways frightening numbers of mountain lions and grizzly bears. And that's a beautiful thing, because it means that the whole system is healthy and together. And we are connected to that and dependent on that health. And, you know, we're seeing all kinds of situations now where if you take all the trees away, if you take all the game away, you have massive erosion and the rivers are fouled and it's harder to grow crops. And so all these breakdowns impact us in very dramatic ways. And so in places where tigers survive and are allowed to survive, and that's really what it has come down to, we're allowing them to survive now. We have achieved such total dominance over other life forms that we are calling the shots now. And that's a kind of a frightening and a sobering responsibility. And the catch with the DNA question, of course you can save their DNA. There are thousands of tigers in captivity. But tigers are higher mammals, and you don't just have a tiger in a cage and then when you create a safe forest for it, let it loose. Tigers are taught by their mothers to how to behave, much as we are. It takes 2 to 3 years to teach a tiger to hunt properly. The cubs stay with their mothers even until they're almost full grown, practicing hunting and tracking scenarios. And if without that teaching, they're incompetent. And there are tiger farms in China where they're raising tigers like veal or chickens. And you watch these tigers when a live animal's thrown in there, and it's a horror show. They're completely incompetent. They don't know what to do with it. You know, they claw it and bite it and maul it, but there's none of the competence that you would have to have if they were going to survive in the wild. So it's really it's a grotesque situation.
And if you think about it, if you think the word tiger, my image instantly is a local zoo, a pacing animal,
yeah.
Relentlessly pacing.
Yeah.
The sadness that you feel when you see that also, I think, is very important.
Yeah, and that's real, and you see that with wolves, too. And I remember going to the Bronx Zoo and watching this polar bear. And polar bears, like tigers and wolves, you know, are used to covering enormous territories. They're wanderers, they're explorers, they're big-time travelers. And watching this polar bear in this perfectly nice pen, but much too small, and it would walk forward 5 steps, stop with a sort of mechanical jerk, and back up, start again, jerk, go forward. It had gone insane. It had gone mad in there. And it was a really chilling thing to see. And for tigers too, you know, cats are extraordinarily adaptable. And if you're bred in captivity and used to only the cage, then what else are you going to know? But it's fundamentally unnatural. And there needs to be a place where tigers can do what tigers are meant to do. There needs to be a place for all of us to do what we were meant to do. And there are so many of us now, we need to figure out how we're going to share that space, to negotiate that balance. And it's really, I don't think we necessarily hired on to be in charge of the tiger's fate, but we are. It's that's how it's come down. And if the tiger goes extinct in the wild, which it's in serious danger of doing now, there are only 3,000 wild tigers left in all of Asia, perhaps 400 in Russia. A 97% drop from 100 years ago. You know, it's dire now, very, very dramatic. If the tiger is allowed to go extinct in the wild, it will be the largest predator to do so since the Pleistocene. So it'll be the first time in 10,000 years that we've lost a species of that size and importance from the planet.
Can you outline what is being done since we have this power? How are we using it?
It's very clear what needs to be done. I mean, here's the upside to this very distressing story is the fact that tigers are incredibly adaptable. They breed really well. If you stay out of their way and give them enough space, they will thrive and flourish and multiply. 2010 is the Chinese year of the tiger, but it is also considered to be the year of the tiger by conservation groups who are working increasingly cooperatively to protect what remains of tiger habitat and the species itself. So this is the year of the tiger. It's a pivotal year in the fate of this animal. What is generally agreed to be the greatest threat to tigers at this time is poaching. Poaching for the illegal trade in tiger skins and tiger parts, which are used for dubious medicines. The second greatest threat is habitat loss due to human expansion and encroachment, logging especially. So, but number one is poaching. And there, in Russia, there was an agency created called Inspection Tiger in the early 90s. And when those officers and wardens went into the forest, poaching was out of control. And when they entered the forest in 1994, it suppressed poaching in a dramatic way, so dramatic that it actually gave the tigers a chance to rebound. The training that these men are given is being funded now all across Asia. And it's demonstrably effective. It's measurably effective. And there are agencies now to whom your donations will make a dramatic difference. You can be assured that when you give money to these particular agencies, it's not going to be going to buy stamps for the next fundraising campaign. It's going to be going to buy gas for vehicles, to buy GPS and radio units so that these officers can stay in touch with each other, often impenetrable forests. So some of these agencies would be panthera.org, which is a pan-Asian agency, really, really excellent. Alan Rabinowitz is associated with it, George Schaller. These are luminaries of tiger research and conservation. Another one is the Wildlife Alliance. Their focus is in Southeast Asia, where the tiger situation is especially dire, but they also have a Russian component called Phoenix Fund, who is dedicating virtually all of its energies to anti-poaching efforts. Another one is 21stCenturyTiger.org, and they guarantee, as Panthera does, that 100% of donations go directly to the field. And another one is Wildlife Conservation Society, is another terrific one. So these folks know the ground that they're working on, they know the issues, they know the people, they know the poachers, and they understand how desperate the circumstances are, and they also are deeply devoted to the preservation of the tiger, which is something that, you know, I think a lot of people can agree on but are confused about, well, how do I do it? How can I help? Well, contributing to these organizations, these charitable groups, will help, absolutely. What you could have taught me, I could have saved some face. They think that you're
The Tiger, a true story of vengeance and survival, is not only a heart-stopping tale, it is a comprehensive exploration of the natural world. John Valiant describes the fate of the iconic tiger. As Valiant says, the tiger is a symbol we all understand.
At the beginning of the last century, it is estimated that there were more than 75,000 tigers living in Asia. Today, you would never know. Within the fragile envelope of a single human memory, 95% of those animals have been killed for sport, for beauty, for medicine, for money, for territory, and for revenge. Looking at distribution maps of tigers then and now is like looking at maps of European Jewry before and after World War II. You simply cannot believe your eyes. It is hard to imagine such a thing as possible, especially when you consider that tigers have accompanied our species throughout its entire history on the Asian continent and have been embraced for their physical, aesthetic, and iconic power.
John Valiant is also the author of the bestseller The Golden Spruce, a true story of myth, madness, and greed. And that concludes our show. Thanks for listening. Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn, Susie Montgomery, and Constance Crompton. For more information, visit sqradio.org.
KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, KUSU FM HD1 Logan.